Adventist World Radio, from broadcast to baptism, powered by SID Media.
Indeed, powered by the SID Media. Now, good afternoon to you, Pastor.
Afternoon, thank you. How are you?
Well, thank you. And are you well?
I'm all right.
Lovely. We are talking about, the fundamental belief, but the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. And yesterday, we looked at the incredible life of Jesus. And today, we confront the most painful yet glorious moment in human history, the death of Christ. The cross was not merely a tragic event. It was a planned, voluntary substitution. Jesus took our place, bearing the penalty of sin to satisfy justice and to prove that God's law is actually loving. I want to discuss how the cross secures our salvation. Now, Pastor, how does the Bible explain the substitutionary atonement that actually happened legally and spiritually on the cross?
Well, if we were to find, perhaps if we were to hinge our explanations on one text, I like how Philippians puts it in Philippians chapter 2, where it gives us a very nice tone. You know, unlike what many feel or many think, this was an act, the Father sent the Son, you know. And, you know, there's that notion in among Christians that the Father, I don't know if you've heard it, but I've heard it, that there was more of a search for someone to die for us until Jesus volunteered, and then until the Father sends the Son and so on. But I like the way Philippians chapter 2 puts it, because in Philippians, it is clear that the Son volunteered for this, and as much as he is a volunteer in this, he is also executing the will of his Father. So the Bible shows us that he humbled himself and became in the likeness of sinful man, and then there's so many other places that we can read, but of course we are looking also here about what happened on the cross, and legally and spiritually. How does the act of the cross secure our salvation? Of course, we will begin by looking at the accusation that the devil has had against God, that the law of God cannot be kept. And it's very nice. It's very profound when you dig into the love of God at the cross, and you see that what actually crushes the devil, if we were to look on the side of the controversy, what actually crushes the devil is the act of love. You see, because the devil argues that God does not love us. The devil argues that God is not loving. But God demonstrates his ultimate love for us by giving up his own Son to die, and by he himself dying. In Romans is a text that says, he who did not spare his own Son. Other theologians would say, he who did not spare himself, because by not sparing his own Son, he is not sparing himself. So he gives up himself to demonstrate his own love. Some scholars say when he gave up his Son, heaven was bankrupt. Because the greatest treasure of heaven was not there. So he demonstrates his love. And by demonstrating his love, that's what crushes the devil's argument. That's what destroys the devil's argument. And I like it, because that's where Christ then declares, it is finished. The argument of the controversy is done. It is, the strongest conquest. When we are looking at it legally, we are seeing God vindicating his own character, you know, and God on the other part, we see him also purchasing us back. You see, when we look back in Eden, there is some sort of transaction there where we are plunged into sin and we are under the rule of the enemy. But God redeems us back, and His redemption, the price of our redemption, is Himself.
Now, why is it vital to understand that Christ's death was a voluntary sacrifice, not just a murder to defeat sin?
Wow, I like this. And this is no wonder why I began with the text from, I would like to encourage our listeners to take time to look at it from Philippians, because in Philippians we see that the Bible tells us that he yielded himself. He became obedient unto death. The Bible says that in Philippians chapter 2, we start from verse 5, it says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ, who, being in form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bond servant." You know, it says he made himself of no reputation. We are seeing an action which is done by himself, or not an action which is imposed on him or forced on him, but an action which is done by himself. And this alone, it eliminates the thing, you know, the notion that this was a murder. This was not a murder. Even when you read from his own statement in the gospel, he says, "For this purpose I came." You know, he's speaking of his death. He's saying, "This is what I came for. It's something that has been, it's been preordained. It has been planned." He planned to come and die for us. So this is not a murder, and it is very important to realize this, that this is an act by God, a voluntary sacrifice, and this has been done to defeat sin. It's something that was done for you and for me, that we should not go, that we should not face death. So he faced it on our behalf, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life.
Indeed, whoever believes in him will have everlasting life. Now, how does the death of the Messiah answer the accusations made by the enemy, the devil, against God's character in the great controversy?
Well, the death of Christ on the cross, it vindicated, when Christ died on the cross, he vindicated himself before the whole universe, by displaying the true, you know, the deepest aspect of his life. Jesus said that greater love hath no man than this, than that a man yields his life for another. And that's exactly what we see Christ doing. We see him giving up his own life that we may have life. We see a transaction taking place where he even just by coming down here, he chose to be poor so that we should be rich. You know, he chose to take up the cross so that we should put on a crown. He chose to be wounded so that we should be healed. So we see that act, by that mere act of love, he demonstrates before us, firstly, and before all creation, that he loves us so much, you know, to the extent that he is willing to give himself for us. And one fascinating thought that I like from the Spirit of Prophecy is where Sister White speaks of something that it always baffles my mind every day, and I like to think about this thought. It just tells me how deep God's love is for us. That if I was the only one, or the only sinner on earth, Christ would have come and died for me alone. He would have done it for me again. You know, it's not about the whole world. It is about me. It is not about, you know, everyone else. It's awesome when I think about it that way, that it is just about me. It is just about you who is listening there. It's about you. Had it been you alone, he would do it again just for you. And so in this act of love, he vindicates and he crushes the whole argument of the enemy that God is not loving and that his law cannot be kept. He lives a sinless life, and he vindicates his character by displaying the ultimate an act of love, laying down his life for us.
Now, does the phrase "it is finished, tetelestai" die apply to the ceremonial law or the plan of salvation or redemption or both?
Okay, so the phrase tetelestai, wonderful. The phrase tetelestai at the death of Christ the phrase only applies to the ceremonial law and not the plan of redemption altogether. Because we know from the teaching of the sanctuary that the plan of redemption has three major phases. And the first phase is what we see in the sanctuary, which happens in the outer court, which is what we are seeing, you know, at the cross, that Jesus is dying, you know. But after his death, there is more to the plan of redemption. But of course, we could say, when he declared it is finished, it is we could see it in different dimensions and aspects. He's declaring that the ultimate sacrifice has been paid once for all. He's declaring that the devil himself has been defeated in the sense that the character of God has been vindicated, you know, and the whole creation has seen that this is who God truly is, contrary to the lies of the devil. So the argument is done, you know, in that sense, and the sacrifice has been paid, you know, and the ceremonial things have been done away with. But the plan of redemption, in the sense that it still has some phases to it. The atonement has the atoning sacrifice has been paid. The substitute has been paid, and it is and the Bible in fact says something very profound, which I'd like to make mention here. Before he said it is finished, the Bible said, Jesus, having seen that all things were accomplished, then he said, it is finished. You know, he declares it when everything was paid, when everything was done, when the full measure was paid, and then he declares it is finished, and he gives up the ghost. So in brief, we're saying the ceremonial laws, the laws dealing with the sacrifices, the laws dealing with the rituals, and all those other things which we are pointing to Christ, which were a shadow of things to come, they have all been met at the cross. So that is that is also there in the declaration. It is finished. But when we talk about the plan of redemption, there is it is finished in the sense that the ultimate sacrifice has been paid. But the plan has other phases. There's a phase where Jesus goes up in the sanctuary. He's still ministering, so we cannot say it is finished. We cannot rule out all that and say it is finished. Because there is that phase, and there's another phase which we are seeing, which is taking place now in the Holy of Holies, where Christ is ministering, is blotting away the sins which have been recorded and which are still being recorded in the sanctuary.
Now, what does the tearing of the temple veil signify regarding our access to God and after Christ's death?
Well, the tearing of the temple veil has a very deep significance in sanctuary theology and the atonement theology, because it signifies that, you know, because this veil, let me just give a brief background. This veil, it's a very interesting thing. I wish we had much time to deal with this, but this veil is an earthly thing. Well, we need to realize that, because this veil is for the protection of the priests. This veil was for the protection of the priest, so that the glory, the Shekinah glory in the Holy of Holies, should not destroy the priest or should not kill the priest.
Mm.
And so there was this veil. But this the tearing of this veil is rent because Christ now becomes our veil.
Yeah.
You know, because he's the one who is going up to heaven, and he is the one who stands between us and the Father. That division which was there is no longer there, and we can have God himself as our veil, you know, and this speaks to a certain nearness that occurs, you know, after the death of Christ and even just at the incarnation of Christ, in that God himself has come down to has come down to our level, and he is our veil. So there's a lot of deep significance, especially dealing with our access to God, that we can have somebody who has gone beyond the veil, you know. So we can approach God boldly. That's why in Hebrews chapter 4 it says, it speaks of Jesus who has ascended into the heavens, and it does not end there. It says he has not just ascended into the heavens, but he has ascended into the sanctuary, and he is standing before God. So he has crossed beyond the veil. And because he is there, we have access to the Father through him. It says, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. We can have direct access to the Father through Jesus Christ, and through the merits of his sacrifice, all our prayers go in as perfect. All our prayers, though we may pray broken prayers. There's a saying that goes around, that even a broken prayer is a prayer. And the only reason why a broken prayer is a prayer is because, number one, the veil has been rent, and we are going to the Father through Jesus Christ. And because we go through Jesus Christ, the perfection of Christ becomes our perfection, you know, and our prayers, no matter how broken they may be, they go to the Father as perfect.
Mm. Pastor, I must thank you so much for coming through. It's been a fantastic afternoon. We're going to be connecting with you once again tomorrow at the same time, same place. I must make sure that as you join us tomorrow, at least there's one question that I need to put through so that we don't have to go. How do we balance the immense suffering of Christ with the ultimate message of hope and victory found in his death?
Okay. We look at the death of Christ as the ultimate sacrifice.
Mm.
And we see that there is hope even beyond the grave, because when Ellen White says he went into the tomb to lighten the tomb, we see that the Bible tells us that the same power that raised Jesus shall raise us up also again. So even despite the immense sacrifice that Christ did, there is ultimately, in all that he did, there is hope, because he did not remain in the grave. I think this would be my punchline in this part. He did not remain in the grave.
Yeah.
But he conquered death. And because he conquered death, there is hope for us. Even in death, we can still die in hope. We may be sick, but we should remember this one thing. You may be terminally ill, but you should remember that he went through the tomb to lighten the tomb. You know, because he conquered death, if you are in him, you will not remain in the tomb, but you will resurrect with Christ. That the same power that resurrected Christ can resurrect you again.
Mm. The same power that resurrected the Messiah, the Christ, will also resurrect you again. Pastor, we'll talk to you again tomorrow, same time and same place.
Adventist World Radio SID Media. We are not general practitioners. We are specialists in Bible-based content.